breaking news right now. Tensions rising in the Gulf following the tanker attack near Iran. The U.S. releasing this new video of what it says are Iranians removing an unexploded mine from one of the vessels. This coming after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo placed blame on Iran for the attacks.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders leaving her post as White House press secretary after more than 3 years in a very tough job.
I think the Mexico tariffs were a huge distraction. And I think that when it comes back to this period where we are now, we're continuing to see accommodation from not only from the Fed, but you saw comments out of the ECB, out of the BOJ last week. We have more tools. We will use them. I continue to think that the market is fueled on the basis of the fact that we're going to continue to have accommodative monetary policy and liquidity being provided to the market. I think that the equity markets are overstating the benefit that a rate cut will give to them in the back half of the year.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, markets come in a little bit mixed this week. Tensions in the Middle East as Iranians torpedo two oil tankers in the Straits of Hormuz. Interest rates continue their decline. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Richard Dixon will be joining me in the first hour from Lowry's as we talk about, in his view, full speed ahead as all of his indicators are saying a buy. Also later on in the program, Damian Moore will be joining us from Moody's as we look at some of the risk of the BBB corporate bond market. Where have you heard that before? And in the big picture today, we're going to make a strong case for owning gold. All of that coming up in today's program.
There were a lot of side stories this week. Nothing was as big as the Federal Open Mouth Committee intimating a slight accommodative tilt last week, but that sent the equity markets up 4%. We did, however, get a nice kickstart on Monday to carry the baton from last week's rally with the news that the U.S. and Mexico had reached a deal on immigration to avoid tariffs that were scheduled to be imposed that Monday. And that helped the S&P 500 get above 2,900 intraday for the first time since early May. And Trump did, however, say he would reinstate the tariffs if the U.S. thinks Mexico isn't doing enough to stop the flow of illegal immigration right into the U.S. So while we're on the subject of trade, let's talk about a couple more headlines this week. Right now, negotiations remain at a standstill ahead of the G20 meeting in Japan at the end of the month. Nothing's been negotiated, nothing's been arranged. Trump has threatened this week he's ready to move forward on the next tranche of tariffs if the Chinese aren't willing to agree to those concessions that were negotiated early this year, and if President Xi won't meet him at the G20 meeting to discuss trade. So China's director of the Institute of International Trade, a unit under the Ministry of Commerce, said this week that China could meet at the G20, but they want to see the U.S. stick to agreements made last year to suspend additional tariffs. They said that the U.S. needs to show good faith. So to bolster their defense during this trade war, China's finance ministry said Tuesday it would ease restrictions on spending of proceeds from special bonds of local governments. And the Chinese government also encouraged banks to loan on projects funded by these bonds, which are typically used for major infrastructure plans. And then the Chinese equities rallied very strongly on that news. And then there was the People's Bank of China, which also took steps this week to strengthen the yuan to stem the tide of maybe capital considering leaving the country. As if you look at Chinese Shanghai index, it did fall quite a bit in May, and a very slight blip this week on this news. But let's talk about two more side stories this week besides trade. First being the hit to semiconductors from Evercore ISI's commentary, and then the other one was from Broadcom's earnings. And the second story this week is in oil, essentially with the two tankers that were attacked and the weakness in the price of oil earlier this week on inventory data and demand downgrades from IEA and the EIA. So let's talk about the first thing. So semiconductors were hit this week from Evercore ISI's research, which essentially released some commentary saying, weakness in memory chip business could persist well into 2020. If our listeners recall, back in March, I was discussing some of Micron's earnings at the time, which was a catalyst for semiconductors, in which they were saying that DRAM shipments they expected would go up in the third and fourth quarter. So that reassuring confidence did really help a lot of that sector do very well in the first quarter. Evercore ISI isn't as optimistic, and they're predicting, again, like I said, 2020, that the slowness and the weakness broadly in the memory chip business could persist till then. And then this Friday, Broadcom missed earnings and guided revenues below the 2019 consensus. They cited essentially geopolitical uncertainty and export restrictions with Huawei. Trade and Huawei are definitely two catalysts that Micron couldn't have foreseen at the time back in March, now that trade negotiations have broken down between the U.S. and China in May. Finally, let's take a look at that final side story this week. Two tankers were hit in the Gulf of Oman, but by what? Really, nobody knows. It could be mines, torpedoes, or something else. It's going to take some time to essentially investigate just what. But there's definitely some finger pointing going on right now. The U.S. is currently blaming Iran, but it also could be related to issues right now in Yemen with Saudi Arabia. The Houthi movement continues very strongly there, and there's been a lot of attacks. In fact, just this week, there was a strike on a Saudi airport, right about the time that the attacks were happening, I think the day before or same day. Now, the U.S. is considering military escorts, and Trump has warned Iran if it attempts to close the Straits of Hormuz, it wouldn't be closed very long. Obviously, you can understand what he's intimating there with probably some military operations. Oil rallied shortly on that day of the attack, but declined essentially most of this week on demand concerns and rising inventories in the U.S. Those were the main drivers, essentially keeping prices low this week. Now, the EIA early in the week cut global oil demand from 1.4 million barrels per day to 1.2 million this month from last month. And those are the projections going forward. U.S. oil inventories came in higher this week. They were up around 2.2 million in the week through June 7th. And then International Energy Agency, IEA, followed suit with the EIA. Let's just mix around those three letters, right? And form an energy agency. You know, they followed suit with essentially cutting their global demand outlook and saying basically oil demand growth is slowing to the lowest levels in years. So that's it pretty much for this week. A lot of side stories affecting maybe some micro levels of the market. Nothing very broad and sweeping as like we saw with anything concerning the Fed last week. Now, next week, we'll have the Fed meeting right around Wednesday. They'll release their policy statement, but they're meeting Tuesday and Wednesday. And what many are expecting to hear is that the Fed will be considering a policy shift, explaining that, talking about what that means. And the Fed futures are really talking about, if you look at where they're at, is a very high percent chance that we'll see a rate cut in July and possibly in September. But going out to the end of the year, they're predicting three rate cuts. And so essentially the Fed fund futures, and if you look at the 10-year treasury, the long end of the yield curve, which continues to fall in yields since the beginning of the year, both of those things, the treasuries and the Fed fund futures, are telling the Fed, you need to cut interest rates, looking at the uncertainty regarding trade and how that's affecting manufacturing abroad. So that's it for me. We'll talk to you guys next week, and we'll talk about that Fed meeting and see what they're saying. Baby, if you run away. Baby, if you leave. I'm so in love with you, girl. You make me feel brand new. Come on, give it up to me. Let me take care of you. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
At some point, from my point of view, the faith in central banks will be about tested again, and the trust in central banks will be tested, and it's pretty amazing to see that institutional demand was really kicking in recently. We have seen that the GLD, the gold ETF, saw its biggest single day asset inflow since the Brexit yesterday. So there's really, really lots of money coming in from the sidelines. And this is exactly what we described in the In Gold We Trust report. We said that institutional demand will be really the tipping point, or the factor that really moves the needle. And we are seeing that so many players used to be on the sidelines. And I think as soon as we go above this massive resistance zone at 1350 to 1370, and it was really be tough to go above that resistance, but as soon as we go over that, I think we will see a massive inflow from institutional investors. And then we can go to 1450, 1500, probably within a couple of weeks.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Stocks coming in a little bit mixed this week. We had all kinds of things going on in the market. Tensions in the Middle East with a little spike in oil as interest rates head lower. Where are the markets heading? Are we getting into that sell away and go away, or will it be different? Joining us on the program from Lowry's Research is Richard Dixon. Richard, let's start out with two of your very famous indicators. You have two measures that you use, buying pressure and selling pressure, that really tells you underneath the market what's going on. Why don't we begin with that, and what is it telling you right now?
Well, as a matter of fact, last week we just got a new buy signal that's generated by signs that the demand is now in control of the market. So our buy power index is above our selling pressure index. That corresponded with the rally off the June 3rd intraday low for the S&P 500. So overall, we still have a positive trend in terms of supply and demand. Our outlook for the market is still positive.
Now, Richard, one of your other indicators is selling pressure in the recent correction, and let's say the big correction that preceded it last fall. Were any of your selling pressure indicators telling you or warning you that a lot of sellers were coming into the market?
Yeah, absolutely. We had some, I can tell you precisely, when we were getting sell signals from our selling pressure index, we started out with actually right around the middle part of October. We had our first sell signal. And that told us at that point that sellers were basically dominant in the market. Obviously, this was about a month after prices started going down. And things stayed negative until after the December 24th low in the market. And at that point, we had an abundance of signs of strength coming off that December 4th low. On December 26th, we had what we call the 90% up day, in which up volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 90% or more of the total up-down volume. And we have an indicator called points gained and points lost, which is basically a accumulation of the points gained on all the advancing issues on the exchange on any given day, and points lost, obviously, the declining issues. So we had over 90% points gained as well. That was followed very shortly thereafter with a buying control. Well, actually, we had the buying control on that same day, on the 26th, as the 90% up day. That was followed by a supplemental buy on the 7th, January 7th. We also had several other indications of strength, a very strong expansion in short-term demand, as measured by our short-term index, which is just simply a shorter-term version of buying power, and also a very, very powerful expansion in breadth, better than 9-to-1 advancing issues over declining issues, which is an extremely rare event in the market. So there was an abundance of indications that, yes, we're starting a very, very strong rally. Interestingly enough, in the rally off the June 3rd low, on January 4th, we actually had three buy signals on June 4th. We had another buying control. We had a couple of short-term signals as well. So you put that together, plus we had with our what we call our operating companies only data. That is made up strictly of common stocks. We try to filter out the interest-sensitive non-common stock issues that trade on the New York Stock Exchange. And in this environment, we think that's especially important since we have had the rally in bonds and the big drop in interest rates, which has helped boost these what we call non-operating company issues. So we had a 90% up day with our operating company issues as well. So we had an abundance of signs of strength coming off that June 3rd low on June 4th. So we feel pretty comfortable saying that the market appears to be on the way to making new highs once again on a very short-term basis. Obviously, things are a bit overbought, but there has been a continued absence of selling, which is, again, a positive sign. And you know, we had the last hour rally yesterday. Now today, we still have almost half an hour to go, so who knows what will happen. But we reversed an early loss, and now the Dow has turned positive again. But overall, things look pretty good right now.
Richard, I know you also follow individual sectors. What does it tell you when you have sectors like consumer staples breaking out to new highs, utilities breaking out to new highs, real estate investment trusts breaking out to new highs? Is this simply the market responding to dropping bond yields with these sectors?
And certainly in the case of utilities and in the case of REITs, yeah, you would expect that there is a reaction. Interestingly enough, you know, we're sort of in a way with the inverted yield curve that we have in the very short end to the longer end, we're almost back into that TINA market like we had back 2009, 2010, 2011. We had, you know, zero interest rates because you have a dividend yield of about 2% right now in the S&P. That's better than a five-year yield. It's about equal to a 10-year Treasury note yield. The only thing it's less than is obviously Fed funds, which are over 2%, and a three-month T-bill, which is also over 2%. So, you know, there is somewhat of a, I think, a motivation to look towards high-yielding common stocks again as a source of income rather than tying your money up into, say, a five-year or 10-year note, which is actually yielding about the same or even less than what you're getting in the S&P right now, not to mention the yield that you're looking at in certain REITs and certainly in utility stocks. To strengthen consumers in non-cyclicals, consumer staples, may be really twofold. One, value has been a real laggard in this market. And so you may have people thinking that, you know, Infotech, for instance, some of the industrials, cyclicals overall, obviously were big beneficiaries in the rally in the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter. Value has been lagging. So there may be somewhat of a move towards these value stocks as laggards. Plus, you do have some uncertainty as far as, you know, what's the durability of this rally. You started off the comments about, you know, sell in May and go away. When you've had a 16% gain in basically the first quarter for the S&P, the motivation is pretty strong to say, look, you know, let's take our money and go home, or at least put it into less volatile stocks, lower beta stocks, where if the market does have a correction, we can sort of so hide out in those. So I think it's a combination of factors that are in play as far as the strength you're seeing in some of these defensive areas and interest-sensitive areas.
You know, Richard, the market right now, the futures market is pricing in two or three rate cuts coming from the Fed as soon as possibly July. But I just, you know, from experience, I can't imagine if your buy signals and everything that's telling you that this market is heading higher to new records, I cannot imagine the Fed lowering interest rates when the market is hitting all-time records. That would be like almost fueling a bubble. So, you know, I don't know how you feel about that. My own personal opinion is the futures market may have this wrong if indeed your signals are telling you we're going to hit new records in the market.
Yeah, that's really sort of outside our area of expertise. Basically, what we can look at is the force of supply and demand in the market and try to determine
the probabilities of are we going up or are we going down? And right now, those forces suggest we're going up.
If you're taking a look at this market, your signals are telling you selling pressure is weak, buying pressure with demand coming in this market is very strong. Your operating companies are all heading up. As an investor, if you had money on the sidelines or you've been reluctant to get in the market, what would you be telling investors to do right now?
Well, I think if you're long-term, in other words, you're not looking at the next, the rest of this quarter, for instance, or maybe even to the next quarter. If you're longer-term, I see no reason why you shouldn't be putting money into the market right now. If you're extremely price-sensitive, and by that I mean extremely price-sensitive, obviously on a short-term basis, things look a little bit extended. That straight-up rally we had, 5 days, 6 days, depending upon the S&P or the Dow you're talking about, push things into a very, very short-term overbought level. If you're a short-term trader, you're probably going to sit on the sidelines and let's see what kind of pullback we get. But I think the danger, if you're saying, well, let's wait for a pullback, if you're an investor, is that the next thing you know, things are making new highs and you're still waiting for the pullback. The classic example of that was the rally off the December low, where if you remember, a lot of people felt like this was a bear market rally. Well, the S&P was down 19.9%. to the December low, very much a classic definition in price terms of the bear market. So it's a bear market rally, or the more optimistic people were saying, it's a nice rally, but there's going to be a test. There was no test. It just went up. It was a classic lockout rally, which is fairly obvious given the kind of strength that we saw as this market took off from the December low. So, you're waiting for the pullback, it never comes. And you finally say, okay, well, maybe I should go ahead and buy now, but at a much higher price than what you could have gotten in. And I think you're in the same situation now, probably not to the extent, I'd be surprised, and this is an opinion, that you're going to see another 16% gain in the S&P between now and the end of the year. But you very easily could see higher prices. We're talking about new highs. So if you're sitting back waiting for the pullback, you may very well end up buying at a higher price. So again, if you're an investor, I see no reason why you shouldn't be putting money in the market right now.
So as you're looking at this, one of the things this market has done has certainly surprised a lot of people, including the fourth quarter of last year when everything was going for the economy. Corporate earnings were up double digits. We had the tax bill kicking in. The economy was growing at a strong rate. And boom, you had close to a 20% correction. We hit that bottom and then spring right back up. Richard, given all the variables that are operating in this market today, we've got presidential tweets, we've got geopolitical risk, and then we have algo trading. Has that made it a little bit more difficult with your indicators or following this market when you can have algo traders can change the dynamics of the market overnight?
Yeah, I think combination of the algorithmic traders and other structural changes that have occurred in the market over the last, 10 years or so, doing away with the uptick rule, no longer really have a specialist system, electronic exchanges, ETFs. There are a lot of changes that have occurred that all seem to varying degrees, contribute to volatility. They add in algorithmic trading, which I think can even exaggerate. The Wall Street has always been sort of the crowd runs to one side of the boat and then it runs to the other side of the boat. Algorithmic trading, I think, can sort of heighten that tendency and even intensify that tendency. And as a result, the kind of declines that we get can also become exaggerated. The interesting thing is, if you go back and look to see, you can go back to the 1930s and look at bull markets, it was extremely rare to get anything more than one 10% pullback in the Dow Jones during a bull market. Yeah, a couple exceptions. We had the October surprises in 1977, 1978, which were roughly 10% pullbacks. If you want to call that period a bull market, you should probably argue one way or the other. But really, there were nothing more than a 10%. And quite often, there were bull markets that didn't have any 10% pullbacks at all. We have had, since 2009 low, we've had, 2010, we had plus over 10% pullback. 2011, we had over 19% pullback. 2012, we had another pullback, certainly 2015 and 2016, at 15% pullbacks. And then obviously here, just recently from the September high to the December low, we had another almost 20% pullback. Were any of these bear markets? Certainly there didn't seem to be any indication prior to the declines that were classic indications of a major market top, which sort of preconditioned to a bear market. So these are all corrections, but, you know, 19% corrections in the space essentially of, what, 7 years? That is very, well, it's unprecedented. It's simply put. So, you know, you ask yourself why? Well, as you just mentioned, algorithmic trading combined with all these changes in the structure of the market. People ask me, what bothers you? What keeps you awake at night in the market? And, I tell them the thing that keeps me awake is I don't have any clue when a correction starts, how far that correction is going to carry. You know, the way we deal with it is we say, look, keep your eyes open for signs of a bottom. And once you see it, act on it. And that's why, obviously, in December, saw signs of a bottom. You know, just recently, we saw signs of a bottom. We act on it. This was only a 6 or 7% pullback versus a 19% pullback from September to December last year. So it's really the kind of thing where you can't really quantify it anymore. You can't say, well, it's going to be a normal 6, 7% pullback or worse, maybe 10%, a really bad one. Who knows? In this market, that's the uncertainty factor that's been injected into this market that makes it that much more difficult, particularly for the shorter term trader. They want to ride through a 20% pullback, but you never know. Is it going to be a 5% pullback, 15% pullback, or something more than that? So basically, all you have to do is, especially there, you just use money discipline, and when you see signs of a bottom, come back in again. And whether it's 5% down, 10% down, or more, just have to wait and see. So it's a different market than what we've had in the past.
Investors need to get ready for volatility, but what you're saying is your indicators, whether it's weak selling pressure, strong buying pressure, operating companies, it looks like we're heading higher. Richard, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the newsletter that you put out, which is excellent, how could they do so, please?
The easiest thing to do is just go to our website, which is Lowry Research. It's L-W-R-Y, no E, we don't make spices. there you can follow links to the various levels of subscription that we have. You can have free looks at the various levels and really make up your mind whether it's something for you or not.
Well, I'll tell you, your indicators have been spot on. Thank you so much, Richard, for joining us on the program.
You're certainly welcome. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
So we're definitely playing at the high-stakes table right now. Doesn't mean we're going to lose at the high-stakes table, but you're playing for keeps, and that seems to be what we're doing on a couple of fronts. So the risks are very high right now. The rewards are very high as well, too. The risks are something that I don't think we've been accustomed to in the post-crisis period that we're going with right now. So it is definitely a period that is not like what we've seen in recent years, and we'll have to see how this plays out.
One of the issues we've been raising here on the program is the rise of corporate debt in this economic recovery. In fact, it's now got the attention of the Federal Reserve in its semi-annual financial stability report. Joining us on the program is Damian Moore from Moody Analytics. He's written a recent piece called The Risk of Rising U.S. Corporate Debt. Damian, in your recent article, you talk about a number of things. Number one, the rise in corporate debt since 2010 could pose a possible risk to the economy. Let's say growth slows or we get into recession. And you also talk about some of the parallels between collateralized loan obligations and to some of the mortgage lending that went on in the last financial crisis, but you believe that's not unlikely to be the catalyst of the next recession. Let's begin with the rise of corporate debt, which has really been one of the big areas of debt increase in the U.S. economy since 2010.
Yeah, that's right. I think since the financial crisis, we've seen households essentially tapped out on the debt front, and they've been deleveraging. And the real growth area for debt markets overall has been in the corporate sector, particularly the non-financial corporate sector. We've seen non-financial corporate debt grow as a share of GDP from 48% in around 2010 up to now over 57% of GDP.
So when you look at this, what do you attribute this rise in debt? You know, initially, like any smart corporation, if debt and interest levels come down, corporations refinanced coming out of the recession. I mean, if you can bring your interest cost down as a corporation, that's more profits to the bottom line. What was the key driver? Because initially it was a drop in rates, but it continued with massive debt issuance, for example, in 2018.
That's right. So interest rates clearly play a very important role in firm capital decisions. And we've seen them go to essentially all-time lows, especially on the long end of the curve. I think a few other factors are playing a role in that. So we essentially, some of what we saw, say, 2010 through 2013 was something of an undoing of an overcorrection that occurred in the crisis where there was something of a credit crunch. But since that time, we're starting to see is a bit of a yield reach for yield type phenomena among investors. That's a hard to measure thing, but I think the types of the evidence in support of that fueling growth are in things like expansion of, say, high yield debt, expansion of the lower rungs of the investment grade debt categories. We're also seeing loosening of credit terms in terms of a reduction in the number of covenants that apply to new debt issuance.
So when you look at this, you talk about in your article, corporate investment and hiring decisions play an outsized role in the economic cycle and could cause a seemingly small initial shock relative to the size of the overall economy to become a large problem. So even though this may represent a small sector, if this thing unwinds or implodes, it could have major implications for the economy, especially if we head into a recession.
That's absolutely right. I think the more debt is on corporate balance sheets, the more likely, the more interest rate sensitive corporations will become. So if we see a widening of spreads, we could easily see a tightening on investment, freezing of hiring, and that sort of thing. We tried to quantify this in our macro model, just essentially looking at debt as it is today compared to a counterfactual where we have debt as it was at, say, its low point in the early 80s. And just having that additional rate sensitivity from having more debt among non-financial corps slowed GDP growth going into a downturn by an additional 1% per year.
Wow. Let's talk about another issue with this amount of debt. And I just wonder what role QE played in this, and that is BBB debt represents roughly about 50% of outstanding investment-grade debt, which is substantial. And as you know, Damien, bonds or bond funds or bond ETFs are sold to investors on the basis of yield. So if junk bonds were paying 1, 2, or 2.5% more than investment grade for investment-grade bond funds to compete, you think that's one reason why they absorbed or invested so much in BBB debt, or do you think there's another reason?
I certainly think that's a contributing factor. So it's hard to establish how much QE has flattened the curve, but estimates range from anywhere from 20, 30 basis points right out to 100 basis points. Maybe call it an average of 50 basis points. So there's definitely been some compression on the curve. And I think this behavioral phenomenon where you have investors looking for, in a low interest rate environment, looking for high yielding investments has sort of pushed them out into riskier categories of debt. And QE's certainly been a part of that.
Now, what about the issue? And I guess one is of liquidity. If many of these bond funds, or let's say bond ETFs, own a large portion of their holdings in BBB, let's say we go into a recession, a lot of these bonds get downgraded to, let's say, BB. That would force the managers and holders of these bonds to liquidate those bonds. And could we see something like a fire sale? I know in the credit markets last fall, especially as we got into December, when spreads widened, a lot of the prices of these bonds fell precipitously because if everybody's trying to get rid of them, who are the buyers? Could this present a problem in a downturn?
I think that's a big uncertainty. I certainly think that's there's a possible channel there for risk amplification. I think it's unclear how binding those requirements would be and how quickly mutual funds would need to sell off those holdings, but certainly there is a pretty big risk there.
Yeah, I know it has gotten to be a big enough risk that it's gotten the attention of the Fed in its recent semiannual financial stability report. One of the issues the Fed outlined in that report as a possible risk were these triple B rated bonds in the amount that they represent in the corporate bond market. So it's gotten the attention of the Fed. I want to talk about another area that we've seen in this economic cycle, and that is leveraged loans that has also grown in size. In fact, you talk about outstanding balances have doubled from $600 billion in 2008 to almost $1.2 trillion in 2018. That's a big jump.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very big jump. So this segment of the market is essentially represents loans that are syndicated, so-called syndicated loans. These are loans that are arranged by groups of banks and other investors, and with the intent that they're either held directly by that group of investors or packaged and securitized through collateralized loan obligations, a type of securitization. So we've seen big growth, particularly on the CLO side of things. Net CLOs outstanding now account for about half of total leveraged loans, so around $600 billion. And this is a real area that the Fed and other regulators have identified as sort of probably the riskiest sector of the market.
So when we take a look at all of this, and I guess as in the financial crisis between 2007 and 2009, we'd never been put in a position like that where the Fed had to come out and the government and taxpayers had to come out and bail out. One of the things I got from reading the financial stability report from the Fed is nobody really knows how this plays out. In other words, if investment funds that are the main owners of this debt are now suddenly forced to sell this, we don't know what the outcome is when there's no buyers. Could we see unconventional Fed monetary policy come in, for example, and buy up corporate debt to shore up the markets?
I think you can't rule any of that out. I think there are attempts to tighten up what the Fed could do post-crisis. But when you're in the heat of a crisis, some of those constraints certainly become less binding.
I want to talk about another issue that we've seen in this economic cycle, and it currently stands where we are today, and that's the inversion of the yield curve, where you've got three-month Treasury bills at almost 2.25%. The 10-year note is about 2.12%. So does the inversion, you wrote an article, just because the yield curve inverts, it doesn't necessarily cause a recession, but it does reflect conditions that lead to one. Explain that.
So this is just one of a really striking trend in our historical record, that when you look at the slope of the yield curve, the difference between, say, the yield on 10-year Treasury bonds and three-month Treasury bills, back over several decades of history where we've collected data on recessions, you see a striking correlation that once the yield curve inverts, a recession will typically follow within 12 to 18 months. And we can essentially build a probability model that estimates the likelihood of that occurring. And that probability model always suggests a very elevated probability of recession once those conditions apply. Now, what's slightly unique about the current situation is that QE has affected rates in the long end and essentially compressed rates. So compared to a no QE yield curve, we're seeing a more inversion than we would otherwise see. And so one question is whether you should control for that. Is QE artificially distorting the signal about recession? We had tried building that into our probability model and found that there is, in fact, some evidence that QE unless you control for the effects of QE, you're going to overstate your recession probability. But nonetheless, we do think recession odds are higher than they were. And if the yield curve stays inverted, we'd expect those recession odds to keep climbing.
Damian, given the large quantity of indicators that you guys follow, generally, is it what you're seeing now is a slowing trend? Is there anything that you see that may be the harbinger of a recession? You know, slowing doesn't necessarily mean a recession, but are you seeing any, as you mentioned earlier, the risk of a recession are rising? Is that pretty much summing it up?
I think that's right. I think we are seeing the risks of recession rising. I think trade woes are certainly contributing, at least whether or not there are sort of large enough economic effects, is certainly contributing to market pessimism, and market pessimism can become self-reinforcing and lead to recession. And I think markets are so interconnected globally nowadays, it's hard to see any real bright spots.
And, you know, the thing that strikes me about where we've been probably in the last year, whether it's the Fed flipping from, let's say, where it was in December to where it was in the beginning of the year, or it's a presidential tweet on oil, or even on trade war, it seems like there's a lot more political and geopolitical elements that are playing here, which makes it much more difficult to predict.
Absolutely. The uncertainty is really quite high, and all eyes are certainly on the Fed over the next few months.
And what is your expectations, or at Moody's, what do you think is the likely probability that the Fed cuts rates? The futures market is predicting 3 rate cuts. How do you guys see it playing out?
Our current baseline calls for a more moderate path. I think we certainly have the Fed on hold for the rest of the year, and we definitely see the odds of a rate cut have increased dramatically over the last couple of months.
So as you guys look at, and you wrote this article on the risk of corporate debt, right now we know a couple of things. Number one, it is nearly doubled in this economic recovery. I don't care if you're looking at leveraged loans or even looking at the quality of investment grade debt out there. A lot of it is of lower quality. But as you say, right now, we don't know how this could play out. But if it does unwind, it could have a wider impact on the economy, even though it's a smaller fraction of the economy. All right. Well, listen, Damian, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Appreciate the articles you guys write and the work that you do in following the economy. All the best, sir, and hope to talk to you again.
Thank you, and we'll keep at it.
All right. Bye-bye.
I think one of the best trades is going to be gold. If I had to pick my favorite for the next 12 to 24 months, it'd probably be gold.
Where does it go to, beyond 1,400?
Oh, if it goes to 1,400, it goes to 1,700 rather quickly. It has everything going for it in a world of rates that are conceivably going down in the United States and going to zero. It has everything going for us. Remember, we've had 75 years of expanding globalization and trade, and we've built the machine around the belief that that was the way the world was going to be. Now, all of a sudden, it's stopped, and we're reversing that. And so, when you do something like that, when you break something like that, a lot of times the consequences won't be seen at first. It might be seen 1 year, 2 years, 3 years later. So that would make one think that it's possible that we go into recession. It would make one think that rates in the United States go back towards the zero bound level. And of course, in that situation, gold's going to scream.
Now, that was billionaire Paul Tudor Jones, a macro trader on gold, his favorite macro trade for the next 12 to 24 months. And it's not just Tudor Jones. Other smart macro traders like Ray Dalio at Bridgewater, even Jeffrey Gundlach at Doubleline, they're investing in gold. And that is the subject of today's big picture.
You know, Chris, as Paul Tudor Jones was making a case there, there really is a strong case here that could be made for investing in gold, which is what I want to lay out today. Now, there are some pretty smart guys here that are betting on gold for a good reason. Now, if you look at a chart of gold in U.S. dollars, it really hasn't gone anywhere since 2013. But that's only if you're looking at gold in dollars. If you're looking at, for example, gold in other currencies, it's been breaking out and hitting new highs. Of course, the reason is those currencies are falling against gold. But if you look at a chart in dollars, it really hasn't gone anywhere since 2013. It's been stuck in U.S. dollars in a trading range between, let's say, 1350 and 1125, and that has lasted probably for about 5 or 6 years. Now, this last decade up until this time has really been a decade of paper assets. The asset class to be in this decade has been most definitely stocks and bonds, not commodities. Gold and oil reached their zenith in 2011 and have been in downward trends and consolidating ever since then. In the case of oil, it's been new supply coming from shale. In the case of gold, it's been higher interest rates and a strong dollar that has led to a fall in gold in comparison to, let's say, other asset classes like stocks and bonds.
You know, this is interesting. What makes you bullish on precious metals now?
You know, I think there's probably 3 fundamental factors driving gold going forward, and let's just outline them here. One is geopolitical events. Two is central bank buying and central bank policy. Three, supply and demand. Now, Chris, if you look on the day we're doing this podcast, which is Thursday, headline news was the U.S. Navy assisting two torpedoed tankers in the Persian Gulf that were most likely torpedoed by Iranian gunboats. Now, today's attack follows a similar attack on a tanker last month. The U.S. has now sent a carrier battle group in the region. Now, why this is important, a third of the world's oil passes through the Straits of Hormuz on a daily basis, and the Persian Gulf contains 55% of the world's oil reserves reside in this area. Now, we've covered on a previous show, there's a distinct possibility of a possible breakout of war in the region as Iran is increasingly moving troops into the region. But it isn't just oil in the Middle East. It is trade tensions between the U.S. and China, which also creates instability, and if not resolved soon, could possibly tip the U.S. and global economies into a recession. Now, under those circumstances, gold could act as a hedge against a falling stock market and a contracting economy. Now, if a recession was to emerge in the U.S., we could see difficulties in the corporate bond markets, as we covered with Damian Moore from Moody's today, with the majority of U.S. corporate debt being very low quality. And it's not just instability on trade in the Middle East. You have political instability in the U.K. regarding Brexit, with the resignation of Prime Minister Theresa May. And then there's splinter groups throughout much of Europe. Then there's Latin America and, of course, Venezuela. So there's a lot of political uncertainty at the present time. Global growth is slowing down, and the risk of recession is rising. Should this happen to emerge, gold could be the go-to asset.
The attack on this area is especially significant. I mean, just play us through the location and why there's also that worry.
Yeah, it's really important. The Gulf of Oman, where this happened, is connected, Robin, to the Persian Gulf by, as I said, the Strait of Hormuz. That is a 21-mile wide at its narrowest point channel that basically about 30% of all the seaborne oil that flows through the global oil markets passes through there. So it's a critical point of failure for the industry. And there has been a lot of concern, given that it borders Iran on the north side, that given that the U.S. pulled out of the Iran deal and reimposed sanctions on Iran, that this could be potential locus for retaliation. That, of course, we don't know. We don't know who was involved in these incidents today, but certainly that is what's raising fears, reminding oil investors of the potential for tensions here and the potential for this to escalate.
That was a report coming out of CNN talking about the risk of these escalated Iranian attacks that could soon engage the U.S. Navy. But outside the geopolitical risks, Jim, what are the other factors that support your thesis for your case of investing in gold?
You know, the second factor behind my gold thesis is central banks are running out of ammunition to stave off, or let's say, fight a recession. The Fed has been one of the few major central banks to raise interest rates over the last few years, but now the Fed is on hold, having only raised interest rates half of what they were able to do in previous cycles. If you take a look at most of the recessions going back to the 80s, the Fed would raise the Fed funds rate to 5 to 6%. This time around, Chris, they only got to 2.5, so roughly half of what they normally do. Now, if you look at the futures market is betting the next move coming from the Fed is going to be to cut interest rates, pricing in perhaps as many as 3 and possibly 2 interest rate cuts by the end of the year. And if you go across the pond to Europe and Asia, it's even worse, with interest rates that are negative throughout much of Europe and Japan. So if Europe goes into a recession, what tools are left for the ECB or the Bank of Japan other than debt monetization? Now, I want to talk about another topic, too, here in the U.S., the theories about debt and deficits, whether they matter. Once widely shared in Washington, Wall Street, and academia, have fundamentally changed here in the last couple of years. Political support for taming deficits has basically largely disappeared. Nobody's talking about them anymore, even though we're about to hit $1 trillion this year. The new theory, mainly MMT, modern monetary theory, is deficits don't matter. Just spend the money, issue debt, and have the Fed monetize it. Now, the Congressional Budget Office expects, and here's a key thing, average interest rates to rise from where they are now on all outstanding debt of U.S. Treasuries from 2.3% to 3.5% in the next decade. So that tells you interest rates are going up. And the CBO is forecasting the government will spend more on interest on the debt in 2020 than it does on Medicaid. And by 2025, annual interest on the debt will exceed what we now spend on the entire defense budget. So these deficits could explode depending on the results of the next election, where basically Democratic candidates are promising free health care for all, free college, monthly income from the government, and believe it or not, a house for everyone. Now, as crazy as that may sound, that is what they're promising voters. There's no way in hell we have the money to pay for all of that outside debt monetization, which would be positive for gold. So if we look at the gold market today, we are now entering an era where traditional monetary tools are no longer working. This means during the next downturn, it will be massive fiscal spending supported by debt monetization that's going to be used as the policy tool by government. You saw that with Trump coming in with fiscal stimulus, not only in spending, but with tax cuts. So gold under these circumstances is your hedge against a disastrous policy. And one final issue. The other issue is central banks themselves have been the biggest heavy buyers of gold over the last year. What we're seeing now is, and this is happening globally outside the U.S., is a pivot away from the dollar as central banks like Russia and China are building up their gold reserves. They have been the heavy buyers of gold over the last year. Now, according to the World Gold Council, central bank buying of gold during the first quarter was the highest they have seen since 2013, with the WGC reporting 146 tons during the first quarter. That's a 68% increase over the previous year. And it's not just China and Russia. The central banks of Turkey, Qatar, Colombia becoming big buyers of gold, according to Bloomberg Economics. Central bank buying has probably been a key support for gold. That's one of the reasons why you've seen gold narrow in its trading range over the last year. What's supporting it is central bank buying. Gold is now becoming an attractive asset to own when you consider much of the world's sovereign debt has negative interest rates.
Well, Jim, here's some more color on your point.
Reports suggest that central banks are back in the business of buying gold. Already the world's largest investors in gold, Goldhub, said that central bank holdings are more than 30,000 tons and adding it fast with a 61% uplift between January and February this year over 2018. Why? What's it mean? And perhaps more importantly, which central banks are buying into global gold reserves? Simon Popple joins us now from BrookvilleCapital.com, where he initiates a regular gold newsletter. Simon, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you back on deck here today. I want to start, first of all, by talking about which central banks are we talking about here, because it's fairly big in terms of the overall picture.
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, China and Russia and Turkey are probably the standout, even though there does seem to be a movement from west to east. But, I mean, if you look at what's happening in China and Russia, I mean, really, you know, the trend is just incredibly obvious that gold central bank reserves are on the increase. I mean, as you can see here, from 2000, you know, they really have started to creep up, and it's also the same in Russia. If you look at what's happening in Russia, you've got a similar. Well, the trend is definitely the same because of the way they report it. The line is slightly different, but it's very, very clear that central banks are buying more gold.
Now, in that news clip, they say that gold is essentially being transferred from west to east. China, much of Asia, and Russia are buying up the gold being sold into the market by the West, indicating that it's essentially putting in a floor underneath gold now that big players like China are in there buying up all the gold they can get.
You know, Chris, once again, this is a global pivot away from the U.S. dollar in a way for many of these countries to immunize themselves against the dollar trade and political sanctions.
Jim, let's talk about your last fundamental factor, supply versus demand. Break that down a bit, if you would.
You know, Chris, I'm a big believer in peak gold. Gold production has been steadily declining, and it's probably one of the reasons you've seen in the news major gold producers like Barrick and Newmont are buying major gold companies. They are simply not replacing the gold they produce each year, and they're doing very little on the exploration front, and most of their exploration is done on Wall Street, buying other companies. It's much easier. If you want to replace, if you go out and try to explore, find gold, bring it into production, go through the environmental permits, that may take 10 years. It's much easier to go on Wall Street and explore there. And unlike silver, which is consumed, every ounce ever mined in gold still exists today in the form of gold, jewelry, and historical artifacts. But the simple fact is, we are not producing enough gold to meet demand by central banks, or for that matter, investors. So that shortfall is made up from existing gold stock, and that stock comes from existing gold holdings. The only thing that brings that gold out of safekeeping and storage is higher prices. So the third factor behind gold is strong demand coming from big buyers right now, which is central banks. Investors right now, they're asleep, and gold is out of favor. Millennials prefer, let's say, cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin over the hard metal. But you have some very, very smart people right now, like Paul Tudor Jones, Dalio, and Gundlach, who are buying. I know in my own case, I've been gradually accumulating gold over the last year for the first time, Chris, probably well over a decade. I think the last time I bought gold was in 2008.
So you've mentioned a lot of things that really, really make gold look good, Jim. What are the negatives, though? I mean, if I can play devil's advocate here, what are the negatives of owning gold?
Well, if you take gold, it's not for everyone. It depends on your tolerance for risk. For one thing, gold doesn't pay a dividend or interest like you would in a stock or bond. In fact, the only way you're going to get some kind of income out of gold is to own a gold stock, which is high risk and volatile. Personally, I own only two gold stocks, one junior and one producer. So gold stocks, Chris, can be more volatile than regular stocks, and they're probably considered to be a higher risk investment. So if you are, let's say, on the conservative side, I'd probably buy the metal over gold stocks. The other fact is many of the factors I have cited here today in the big picture, quite honestly, may not play out as I've outlined here today. Let's take a few of them. The trade war could end. Trump could stop tweeting. The U.S. and Iran could become good buddies and Middle East tensions die off. Congress becomes physically responsible and balances the debt and deficit. Brexit gets resolved. Climate change goes away. World peace breaks out. We cure cancer. We end poverty. Wall Street becomes ethical. Congress resolves its differences. And my favorite, Trump and Pelosi give each other hugs. Now, if those things happen, you probably don't want to own gold unless you want to get on the good side of your wife in the form of jewelry.
Now, in that clip we played, Paul Tudor Jones sees gold, if it breaks out above $1,400, he sees it going as high as $1,700. Do you buy that, Jim?
Gold always can surprise to the upside, depending on how many of these factors we talked about today could kick in at the same time. When it flies, it goes much higher than what the markets expect, just like oil, and as it did in 2011. I think it has the possibility, Chris, of taking out the old highs if we break out those highs that we reached all the way back in 2011.
So you're making the case that the environment for gold looks good based on three fundamental factors. The first one being global geopolitical tensions. Number two, central bank policies and buying. And then the third one is supply and demand factors, and all of which is why you've been buying gold over the last year. Now, I hate to bring this up, but I personally worry about the risk to gold if Trump and Pelosi are seen hugging.
Yeah, that happens. Say goodbye to your gold investments.
We're in trouble.
Yeah, but outside of that, these things happening, I think the fundamental facts line up in favor of gold.
Now, Jim, as we look ahead into the coming weeks, what do you see on the horizon?
Well, the big thing coming up next week will be the FOMC meeting in June. Many expect that they will set the stage for coming rate cuts, so the market's going to be watching that. Also coming up is the end of the second quarter, so the first half of the year will be over, and we'll be watching and back in corporate earnings season. Will they pick up? Everybody that is very bullish is talking about a second half recovery. Unless the trade war, the Fed starts cutting immediately, I'm just suspect of whether we're going to see a stronger second half than the first half. But those are the things we'll be watching on. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.